Well, it's a pleasure to come back here again after a couple of years to speak in this pulpit, and I do thank the rector and others for their kind invitation to share with you. And the pleasure of actually being part of St Helens just for a little while is considerable, and I hope to have the opportunity of talking to you over... I'm stuck now. In Australia, we always call what we're going to have after church supper. But if I invite you to supper, then all kinds of weird things happen, don't they? And people race out and cook meals. We call our last drink at night supper. So that is what... I invited a whole church to supper the other night at Wimbledon. The rector immediately jumped up and decried my invitation and said there was no supper on. To which I was utterly then bewildered and confused why they weren't going to have supper when I was promised a drink. So, but whatever it is we're going to have, I hope to have the opportunity of meeting some more of you and talking with you, and again next week. It's a pleasure though to talk tonight, not just because it's real nice to be with people who treat me with kindness and gentleness and friendliness, and to actually pick up on some familiar faces and some names that I've forgotten, but it's a pleasure really to speak because I'm speaking on really what can only be accounted as the most important of all subjects. What is a Christian and how to become one? That's fairly heavy stuff. And in fact, I'm not going to do it in the academic tonight, but in the existential, just to put us into non-medical big language. We're going to not just talk about what is a Christian and how to become one, but whether you're a Christian and how you can become one tonight. It's that kind of sermon. Are we ready? Well, what is a Christian? Words can be, of course, used in any old fashion you like, can't they? And you just twist the definition into any pattern that you want to. Christian can mean so many different things. You get a map, an atlas, and it will show you the Christian parts of the world all shaded in with a particular colour, which always amuses Australians enormously because they shade all our continent in the same colour, when in fact it's empty. However, as long as people think we're living there, no one's going to come down and take our desert from us. So, you see, we can colour in this bit's Christian and this bit's Buddhist and this bit maybe Muslim and so on, and Christian can mean that. And for many people it doesn't mean much more than being a Western person. And for lots in our culture and community it has meant being a good person. Although next week's title will tell you what happens to them, and so I can suggest that's not going to be Christian either, because we need to look at why they're going to hell. So what is a Christian? Someone who goes to church, but of course any idiot can go to church, as most of us can see. That's a fairly simple thing to be able to roll along to church. It's neither here nor there. That cannot possibly make you a Christian. In fact, as many a good mouse has wandered in, and I presume they haven't become a Christian. And others will say it's because, well, you've been baptised. That is what makes you a Christian, but of course that can't really do the trick either. Otherwise, the missionary enterprise would just need kind of hoses in India. And as people walk past slowly, you can spray them. We could even do some water bombings with aeroplanes overhead and capture the whole of Nepal in one hit. I mean, anybody can be baptised, can't they? Especially if it was as an infant. I mean, all you had to do was be carried along and cry at the appropriate moment, smile, gurgle and sick all over your godparents, and there you are. You see, you're baptised. I mean, it can't really be very much to be baptised, and if that's what a Christian is, well, it really isn't worth being, is it? Now, I'm going to come to what Jesus says a Christian is. There's no point hearing what Philip Jensen says a Christian is, because that just adds to the long list of definitions that you already have, most of which aren't workable. What does Jesus say a Christian is? But then, of course, you have an immediate problem because he never used the word. It actually wasn't invented until several years after he'd died and risen again. It's only used a couple of times in the New Testament, and it was started off used as a term of abuse for his followers. So it's not so much the word I'm looking at, but what it is to be a Jesus person. What it is to be one of the followers of Jesus, one who in Jesus' terminology or understanding would be what we come to call Christian later on. What did Jesus require of people? And so we look not at my words or at your background or at kind of phony definitions, but at what Jesus himself said to the multitudes as to what is involved in following him. And so if you would turn with me to that passage in Mark chapter 8, which I think if you've got one of the Pew Bibles is page 41 in the New Testament section. Eccentricities run very strong inside Christian people, you'll notice, because they have their page 41 right towards the middle of the back of the Bible. You know, if you're in page 41 and it's something like Deuteronomy, then you've got to keep going another 1,000 pages to find page 41, but don't ask me to explain it. Just keep going to the left, or to the right rather, and you'll find page 41 appears again, and it's the second one through, Mark chapter 8, where it speaks about what Jesus said to the crowds. Verse 34, that's the little number 34, the sentence number, so to speak, 34. So we're all page to page 42. I'm sorry, I'm working for a slightly different Bible to you. He called to the crowds, and along with his disciples, and he said, if anyone would come after me, see, here's the challenge of Jesus, anyone, amongst the crowds, amongst the disciples, if anyone is going to be my follower, then he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever will save his life will lose it, but whoever will lose his life for me and for the Gospels will save it. What does Jesus say you must do to become a Christian? To put not too nice a point on it, his basic idea of what you must do is drop dead. You want to be a Christian? Drop dead. That's the kind of line that Jesus is using. Anyone must lose their lives for my sake and the gospel. Anyone must deny themselves, take up the cross, follow me. Three things really are saying the same thing, that is, to lose your life. The next verse, number 35, spells out what number 34 means, doesn't it? To save your life, to hang on to your life, not to deny yourself, take up the cross and follow me, but to save your life will be to lose it. But to lose your life, that is, to deny yourself, take up the cross, follow me, to lose your life will be in the end to save it. What he requires is that you drop dead. Well, let's look at the words themselves. Deny yourself. What does deny yourself mean? You know how to deny an accusation. Someone says that person is guilty of stealing. You say, no, not I. I didn't do it. To deny the accusation is to say no to the accusation. There are many of us here who know how to deny themselves an ice cream. There are others here who don't know how to deny themselves an ice cream. But we know what it means to deny ourselves an ice cream, and he says no to the ice cream. Jesus says, if anyone wants to come after me, they've got to say no to themselves. No to self itself. Not no to a false accusation, not no to an ice cream of Mercedes-Benz or all things that range between them, but no to your very self. No longer are you going to live your life for yourself. You must now take up the cross and follow me. You must now live for me. You must declare yourself as good as dead and live for me. Taking up the cross is a very vivid image. Of course, we've ruined it by turning it into jewellery. But the cross was, well, it was like those, the old stocks of medieval times, only worse. You know, the stocks, the big plank with the hole that you put your head through and the hands, you put your head, hands and arms through these hands, and you are locked up there for 24 hours while the village around about taunts you and makes fun of you and throws rotten fruit at you. And it's a very, very humiliating experience. One of the colleges at the university I am at has a set of stocks. One of the members of the congregation here tonight has actually lived in that college. I saw a broad grin come across the face. I presume she's been locked up in them. And there's this little initiation, right, where they can lock people up there, and once they're locked in these stocks, of course, you can do anything to them and rub the egg in their face and really have a marvellous time until your turn comes. The person who carried his cross was the person who had been declared guilty in the court. And the very activity of carrying his cross to the place of execution was the declaration of his guilt and the freedom of the citizenry to take whatever advantage of him they wanted, because he was as good as dead. And it was said that many a man, by the time he reached the point of execution, was glad to have arrived. Well, much worse than the stocks, because in the end, it was execution. And Jesus takes this very vivid image, of which they knew well, because thousands of men were crucified just in one day in Palestine in the first century. They knew the imagery of the crucifixion. He took this figure and said, okay, if you're going to be my follower, you've got to go like the person on the way to his execution. You've got to say no to yourself, running your own life, your own way. You've got to drop dead. You've got to lose your life for my sake. Come follow me, because I am the one who goes the way of the cross. Well, when you hear that statement of what a Christian is, one of the questions that should bridle in the back of your mind, it must be, who does this bloke think he is? Now, I suggest to you the reason it doesn't rise up to us automatically is because of 2,000 years. Jesus is that person way back there then. But if someone should say it to you here and now, I would suggest to you that almost automatically your first reaction would be to say, who does this bloke think he is? And if I were to say to you, it's lovely to see you all here tonight. Glad to see you're so young and healthy. You've got a lifetime ahead of you. Now let me tell you what you're to do. Drop everything. Whatever you're doing, whatever course you're doing, doesn't matter really. Drop it now. Doesn't matter. Leave your parents. Don't worry about the fact that someone's died in the family. Leave the family funerals of no consequence anymore. Let the dead bury the dead, as Jesus said. You scrap everything. Come follow me. Do everything I do. Look, many of you are going to be killed en route, but that doesn't matter. Be totally committed to the cause of Philip Jensen. Give your life to it. Give your very blood and sweat and tears to it. Come follow me, even to the point of public humiliation and execution. Give me your life, and your answer would be, who do you think you are? All right? What kind of megalomaniac twit do you think you are? That I am going to give away the only thing I really have, my life, to you. What are you going to do for me? I say, well, if you lose your life for me and my sake, in the end you'll save it. But you refuse to follow me and you are doomed. What kind of maniac have we got here? Is the question to be posed, isn't it? It begs it, really. It's just the 2,000 years in the veneration of Jesus have kind of, we've lost the impact of the extraordinary claim that Jesus is making over the lives of these people. If you're going to be with me, total, complete and utter commitment is the only thing I ask. And he asks it in the very context of who he thinks he is. You see, he has posed the question back in verse 27, number 27. Got to go back a page in your Bibles. Got it there? Just to his disciples, in a little place called Caesarea Philippi. He says, all right, who do men say that I am? Who do people say that I am? And you get all the ancient answers. Answers you wouldn't get today, I suggest to you. Or some say you're John the Baptist, and some say you're Elijah. Some say you're one of the prophets. No, they're ancient world answers. I don't know. I've never met anybody who thought Jesus was John the Baptist or that Jesus was Elijah. I have yet to meet the person who thinks that. But in his day, for various reasons that you can find in Mark's Gospel, that is what people thought. But what of our day? We stood outside our university gates and we interviewed people, and we went actually inside the university too, interviewing people at random on a survey that wasn't explicitly and specifically religious, although the key questions we were after were religious questions. And we asked them, amongst other things, who they thought Jesus was. And we had 10 or 15 different categories of answer that could be given. And, of course, the inevitable one, other. And we filled in what people said. And some say, well, he's a teacher. Some say, oh, a legendary character, the founder of a religion, a first century Jew, someone who didn't exist. There's all kinds of answers that people have as to who Jesus was. The answer that the Apostle Peter gives on this occasion for the very first time, and makes a really turning point in the whole Gospel of Mark, but you read Mark, learn, people know only too well. The answer that Peter gives is, you are the Christ. You are the Christ. Now, most of us today think that Christ is his surname, Mr. J. Christ. You find him in the phone book under C. And by the end of the New Testament time, there is that element of truth in that, but no, that's not the case at this time. The word Christ is a particular, specific title. It's a Greek word. The Hebrew parallel word is the word Messiah. Peter was saying, you are the Messiah. Now, who and what is the Messiah? Well, for centuries, Israel had been looking forward to the coming of the King, the coming of the Messiah, as he was known. Not just any king was this king, but he was the king. God had promised this little nation that their king was going to rule the universe. Many a nation has that kind of thought, of course, doesn't it? That their nation will rule the universe. The whole of the world empires of the universe are going to centre on Sydney. You laugh. Well, so would anybody when they heard the Jerusalem claim too, because it really seemed preposterous. Rome was the centre of the universe. Jerusalem, a conquered minor nothing. A place where it really doesn't matter. A troublesome place because of those awkward Jewish people who had this fantastic dream that they were going to be the rulers of the universe, that they were going to have a king turn up, a king who was going to rule the whole world. And not only the whole world, but for all time he was going to rule. He was going to set up the empire that would last longer than the 1,000 years of the Third Reich, the empire that would last forever. Here is the Messiah coming. And through the first century, there were many messianic movements. Many a Jew came along and said, I am the one, get on your sword, get out your shield, come with me. And many went down in a screaming heap. Oh, messianic movements were around in the underworld kind of shady, zealous characteristics of the first century Judaism. And Jesus was not a militaristic man. Jesus was not a political man. But suddenly, or not so suddenly, inevitably, his disciples came to see that what he was claiming to be was the Messiah. They finally got the sight of the blind man who had just been cured, and they saw clearly for the first time this man is claiming to be the King, the Messiah, the long-awaited, centuries-awaited ruler of Israel who is going to rule the world for all time. This is the one. Here he is at last. This is the Messiah. And Jesus accepts what they say and tells them to keep it quiet for his own reasons that I won't go into now. Tells them to keep it quiet, but then spells out his program. Going to get some MiG fighters in to clean up the Romans, and we'll get some of those tanks that will come down from the north through the Urals, and we'll be able to conquer from... That is not his program. Going to raise up a new constitutional democracy with me elected as the permanent president. That is not his program. He says, yes, it's true. Now let me tell you my program. I am going to go and be captured by the authorities... The Jewish authorities, really, they're going to hand me over to the Romans who have conquered Jerusalem. And when the Romans have got hold of me, they're going to execute me. And then after 3 days, I'll rise. You are the king, the ruler, the Messiah, the conqueror of the universe. It cannot happen to you. I mean, that's ridiculous. Huh? That is what is going to happen to me. I've never met Prince Charles. You may have. I understand he lives somewhere around here. I've never met him, and I don't know what his hopes and aspirations are concerning his coronation. But I would be most surprised if he expected that when we got him into the great abbey on the great day, that if he expected to be executed. It's not the normal method of coronation. Not as far as I understand. We gave Charles the First a go at it, but that was a little after his coronation. It's not the norm, is it? Jesus has been identified. You are the king, he said. That's right, I'm going to be executed. Little wonder that poor old dense Peter couldn't make too much of it. This won't happen to you. He missed that Jesus said he's going to rise again because every Jew believed in the resurrection. That's just like saying I'm going to heaven. So he missed the implication that I'm actually going to come back from the dead to walk in this life in front of you. He missed it. He just heard Jesus saying, I'm going to be executed. And he said, no, no, no. That can't happen. Because he didn't understand yet what Jesus was claiming to do. You see, Jesus was setting up a kingdom that was bigger than Rome. And that was bigger than America. Or the British Empire. Or the Russian power. Or indeed any of the empires that have ever ruled the world. Because Jesus was setting up a universal, spiritual, eternal empire. He wasn't just setting up a political empire, a socio-economic empire, a militaristic empire. He was setting up an empire against death and hell, against Satan and the powers and principalities at work in this world that have got us captured doing the rotten things that we don't want to be doing and keep on doing. He was setting up an empire that was in opposition to death and sin. He was setting up the empire of God. And therefore, he was calling upon people, if you're coming with me, you mustn't walk as Peter is at the moment on Satan's side. That's the exact opposition. You haven't got the message yet, Peter. You mustn't be walking on that side. If you're going to come with me in this empire, give me everything. Nothing less will do now. If you're going to save your life, you must lose it. If you lose your life now, you will save it, because I'm talking about the empire of life and death, of heaven and hell, of eternity. That is the empire he came to establish, and so came to establish it by dying, to overcome death in his resurrection. Who does he think he is? God. That's who he thinks he is. Jesus asked another question, really, in number 29. My translation's a bit better than yours in this. The principle's the same. But what about you? He asked. Who do you say that I am? It's a very different question than the one back in 27. It doesn't look very different, but it is very different. You see, if I was to say to Hugh here, Hugh, who did the British people vote for at the last general election? What would be the answer? Maggie Thatcher. Now if I was to ask another question, who did you vote for? It's a different question, isn't it? Radically different. Previously, we learnt something objective out there. Maggie Thatcher. And some of us went grind, 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 and some went yay, and some of us yawned. But that was all there was to it. I mean, the only thing we found out about Hugh was he vaguely kept up with political events. But now when we're asking him who he voted for, we're not finding out anything objective out there about politics, are we? Now we're about to find out something fascinating about him. Is that right? Radically different. It's about him. Forget it. I'm not going to ask him. You ask him later. And of course his answer will be a swift punch in the face. Oh, he's too polite. His answer will be a polite no, because it's none of your business, is it? You're asking me something private about me now. Very radically different. Not who do men say Jesus is, but who do you say Jesus is? Tells me something not about Jesus, but about you, doesn't it? In our interview of 1,000 people, you see, we said, who do you say Jesus is? Good interview, because it's totally anonymous. Just a stranger in the street. You don't even know it's a religious organisation doing the interview. It's asked a whole range of questions outside of Christianity, as well as questions about the meaning of life and purpose and God and so on. Who do you think Jesus is? 45% of the people who answered said Jesus is God. That is who I think Jesus is. It was actually loaded, the question, in your opinion, who do you think Jesus is? 45% of a university that is a secular university in a pagan and hedonistic culture, far more pagan and hedonistic than the one you experience here, 45% said Jesus is God. 45% in a university where 25% of them are Asian students from Southeast Asia, mainly coming from Buddhist, animist, Muslim background, still 45% of that community were saying Jesus is God. Now I know when you're confronted with your Christian friends and your backs are to the wall in your defence of your position, you can't afford to let them into the secret that you know Jesus is God. But you and I are talking privately here in our public communication. What's going on in your head? Well, the person next to you really doesn't know, do they? And you know, and I know, that you know who Jesus is. There is the trap. Now, there are some people here who may not know who Jesus is. They say, well, look, I've never investigated it. I'm like our friend who spoke earlier. I really don't know about it much. And this congregation is a great place to come and keep learning. The bookstall over there is a great place. There's some interesting books over there. One called A Fresh Start, written by a fellow Australian, so I must give it a little push. John Chapman. Or another one called Basic Christianity, written by John Stott. They're over there on the shelf. There are some other ones as well that you might like to pick up that will give you some look into who Jesus is and how you can know who Jesus is and what is the evidence and information about who Jesus is. For some of you, what I've got to say the rest of the evening really can't take you very much further. I'm still going to say it to you so that you'll know the direction you'd need to go once you discover the truth about Jesus. But at this point in time, you say, well, look, I don't know who Jesus is, and therefore to commit my life to him is fairly stupid, isn't it? I mean, it's very silly to say, well, I don't know who Jesus is, but he can have everything. Huh? Absurd. So you need to actually find out who Jesus is, don't you? And the bookstall, talking to friends here, continuing to come to hear the word of God explained, involved in the courses they run around this church, will give you the opportunity to investigate. But if, as I suspect, many of you know only too well who Jesus is, what have you got to do about it? Well, if Jesus is the ruler of life and death, if Jesus is the one who comes to establish God's kingdom forever, if Jesus is God, the real Messiah, then what is it you should give to him except everything you've got? What is the point of believing in God and not actually giving God any place in your life? What kind of belief in God is that? It's the satanic belief in God. See, the devil believes in God. Anyone can believe in God. Believing in God doesn't make a person a Christian, does it? It's whether God is God in your life. And if you are still running your life your way, then you are God in your life. And what a pitiful God you have. How pathetic it is, and little wonder you're self-centered. And if you know there is God and Jesus is the one, then what he is asking is perfectly appropriate. That you give your life the life that he has given you, that you give your life the life that he created, that you give your life the one which he has died to purchase, that you give your life to him is perfectly appropriate. So who do you think Jesus is? And why should I do it? Well, because it's true, that's why. Because it's true. Now, if you don't know that, check it up. But if you do know it, what are you going to do with truth? Jesus gives reasons as to why you are to do it. You see them there at the end of the chapter. What is the option? It's over page 42 now again, isn't it? What is the option? If you say, I'm not going to give up my life to Jesus, I'm going to hang on to it. I still want to do this and this and this and this. I haven't seen everywhere yet. I haven't conquered the world yet. I haven't risen to the top yet. I haven't married that girl yet. I haven't. I'm still going to hang on to my life because there's all things I want to do for me yet. Then in the end, you'll lose it. What is the option? If you lose your life now for his sake, then in the end, you'll save it. You say, can't I do all these things first? Well, will you ever hear this message again if you do all those things first? Will you not be reinforced in saying no to God? For every time you say no, it becomes easier and easier to put it aside. And will you have the opportunity again? My brother is a Christian, or one of my brothers is a Christian. And he put this proposition to a friend at school long, long time ago now. And the fellow said, I know who Jesus is. I know it's true. I know it's right. Yes, I know I should become a Christian. But my girlfriend is very anti-religious. If I became a Christian, she'd drop me. That is his choice. And so he didn't become a Christian, even though he knew it was true. And to this day, as far as I've ever kept track of that man, he still is not a Christian. Although his girlfriend dropped him a month later for another fellow anyway. But you see, you don't always get the opportunity, you see. Having said no to God like that, the opportunity may not be open again later on. You've made your bed. You lie in it. Stupid, really, isn't it? That's the kind of stupidity that Jesus now picks up with this terribly biting comment. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world if he's going to lose his life? Or what price do you put on your life? What are you going to give in return for your life? For a girlfriend? Oh, come now. What a fickle stupidity that was. But I've seen even more stupid. The drunk who wouldn't give up his alcohol. Well, he wasn't really an alcoholic. In the sense, he wasn't drunk, not the night I spoke to him. It's just that he worked in a community that always went out and got drunk on Thursday nights, and he couldn't face the fellows if he wasn't one of the boys. Oh, he wanted to be a Christian. His mum was a Christian. He wanted to marry a Christian girl because he knew they were the only ones worth marrying. Oh, he wanted the good things that Christianity offered, and he was quite sensible and straight and quite clear in his mind and absolutely right. But he didn't have the guts to face the heavy drinking crowd that went to the pub on Thursday nights. And a big man, 6'3" or so he was, a linesman with a telegraph company, sat and cried, but couldn't repent. It's pathetic, isn't it? What is it that you have in your life that is so valuable that you'll die for it? What is it that you have in your ambitions that is so important that you would sacrifice your life for it? What is it that you want to achieve, see, do, have, be, that could somehow be worth dying for? What does it profit a man to gain everything if he's going to lose his life? And lose it he will. For what Jesus comes to undo is the terrible, utter meaninglessness of death itself. For death is our common lot. And death makes this city meaningless. It makes the activity you see around about you in the hospitals and in the insurance offices and the banks utterly futile, completely meaningless. For what is your life but funeral fodder? What is your existence but the ashes of the crematorium flue? What is your end but a little box of ashes and a shin bone sitting in a niche in a wall, in amongst thousands of other little boxes in thousands of other walls, with a brief and stupid inscription about you, when you started, when you finished, and what you've done? And what have you done? Oh, but you say, I can do so much. I can have degrees that run after my name and titles that run before it. I can have all these books I've written and the companies I've directed and I can have so much. But I tell you, if they write it on your crematorium plaque, it'll be so small no one will be able to read it. But it doesn't matter, because nobody bothers reading them anyway. And even if they do, you won't know about it. You are no different to the beasts of the field. You are no different to a cow, dying, burnt and thrown away. That's all you are, for that's all life is. My last visit, I had the great joy of going to Ilkley Moor up in Yorkshire and singing the great old song with my children about catching your death of cold on Ilkley Moor, and then being buried and eaten by the worms, and the worms eating by the ducks, and we eating the ducks, and so having eaten you on Ilkley Moor by that. An important song to teach your children. It gives the true perception of life. Utterly stupid. meaningless, pointless, barren. You can read it in Sartre, you can read it in Camus, you can read it in the plays of Beckett, you can hear it in the songs of any of the thoughtful singers of today. Life faced with death is a meaningless nonsense. It is meaningless we're born, it is meaningless that we live, it is meaningless that we die. It's just nauseating, says Sartre. That's all it is, isn't it? For if there is no way past death, then there is no way past life. There is no life really to live. We are all like the grand old Duke of York, being marched up the hill to march down again and marched up to march down. We're all like that poor man Sisyphus who is locked up to roll the stone up to the top of the hill to have it roll down again. That's all our activities are, rolling stones up hills that go nowhere. Oh, I get the kudos and the pat on the back, but what are they worth? It's meaningless. And so Jesus says, what do you gain if you gain everything and lose your life? And what are you hanging on to? A place in history? A pleasure? A house? The wife, the husband, the children, the holiday abroad? The fame, the fortune? What? Leo Tolstoy, I can't read in large doses. He's too sad. And also, I'm too lazy. I have gone through Dostoevsky's large selections, but War and Peace has sat on my shelf unread for years. However, I have read, with great benefit to my soul, his short stories, which I can cope with because I don't have to remember too many of those weird Russian names. He tells one short story which is infinitely pathetic. That is full of pathos, in that sense of pathetic. And which captures what Jesus is saying here. It's the story of a poor Russian man, as all Tolstoy's stories are of poor Russians, who, saving all his wealth together, goes to a foreign part of Russia to take part in a great land grant scheme that is being developed, where new agricultural grounds are being opened up. And he, in his senior years of 60 or so, goes there to acquire land for his future in family and the rest, and for himself to live his retirement. And the principle of the land grant was one, a very clever one, actually used in certain periods of history, that of you can have as much land as you can encircle from sun up to sundown. But of course the key to it was that you had to encircle it. You couldn't have the circle left open, because then no one would have how much land you really did have. So you take your markers with you and you run. As soon as the first ray of light starts at the day, you run and you leave your markers all the way around your ground that you are pegging out. And provided you get back before the last ray of the sun disappears, get back to the place you've started, everything within it is yours. But if you don't do that, if you don't get all the way back, nothing is yours. It's a great challenge, isn't it? It's a great game. And so this man, having crossed Russia on foot, pays down his money, gets to the top of the hill, sees the sun rise, and heads off in the direction that he has actually surveyed the day before to work out which bits of land to go for. And Tolstoy describes, in better terms than I can, of course, the ardour of running, the difficulty and the hard choices the man faces. I mean, if he reaches a certain stage by morning coffee, well then he'll be able to go around a swamp which will take in very fertile grounds on the other side. But he figures if he hasn't got there by the right time, well then he better forget the swamp and forget the good ground that's involved and take the lesser route. He gets there in time and does the long route, and he runs and hard all day and sheds himself of his clothing and of his food. And towards the end of the late afternoon, he's coming back to the point at which he started, and he reaches the bottom of the hill. And as he comes to the bottom of the hill, the sun drops behind the hills on the other side, and he is beaten. And he lies exhausted on the ground, and he hears with bitterness the cheers and jeers of the men up the top of the hill who started him off. How terrible that they put the boot in. And he looks up at them and realises that they are still in the sunlight, and that they're not booing him, they're actually encouraging him. And he realises that because it's the top of the hill, he is actually in the shadow, but the shadow is moving up the hill. And so, with his last effort that he could possibly muster, He raises himself up to run up the hill to get ahead of the shadow so that he could arrive back there in these last few moments of the sunlight. And sure enough, just as he gets to the top of the hill, he sees the last rays of sun and has taken it all. But then, with the effort that has been involved, he has a massive heart attack. And so he dies. Tolstoy, master storyteller that he is, you see, poses a question that's actually written in the heading of the story. It's a story, a lovely little story called How Much Land Does a Man Need? And he has this incredibly bitter comment down the bottom, the last sentence of the story, where he answers the question, 6 foot by 2. That is how much land we need. What does it profit us to gain everything and lose our life? What do you give in return for your life? Jesus comes into the world to die for you that you may have life and have it eternally. But to have it, you must lose life now to him. If you save it now, you lose it then. If you lose it for my sake and the gospel, you save it then. And so do you see why it is that Jesus makes that incredible claim that if anyone would follow after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. That is what a Christian is, and that is how you become one. Well, what of you? Some of you are at a point of saying, I don't know. There's three groups really here tonight. There are some who will say, I don't know. I just don't know the evidence. I don't know whether Jesus is who he is. I've never realised before tonight how ignorant I am about it all. I really don't know. Well, don't be ignorant, friends. Why on earth would anyone want to be ignorant, especially on a subject that could be as vital and as important as this one? Go over to the bookshop, get some books, talk to people here, come back again, keep listening, read your Bibles. It's a very excellent standard text on the book. Read the rest of the book of Mark. Find out. I wish you no more than that tonight. I would long you for more, I would wish for more than that, but I'd suggest you take no more steps than that because it's silly to give your life to something that you're totally ignorant about. And we don't want silly Christians. There's a second group of people here who know exactly who Jesus is. And they know the kingdom that he has come to establish is the kingdom of eternity. And they have given their lives to him and rejoice to hear again this night. And for you, I want you now to be especially prayerful for those around about you who are with us in the third category. Those who know it's true but have never done anything about it. And I'm sure, just statistically, that there are many of you here tonight like that too. What do you need to do? Well, I've told you over and again, but how, Philip? How do we do it? Well, it's by talking to God about it, of course. We need to pray.